Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, a product of the Health Policy Research Consortium, a CTIS program, your weekly podcast empowering communities to use policy as a vehicle to improve their health and learn how to mobilize your community to create positive change where you live, work, and worship. Wait not a minute more. It's time to get started with the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast.
Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. I'm your host, Patricia Terrell, and joining me is Byron Soji Thomas with the Health Policy Research Consortium. Byron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Patricia. It's good to be here.
So tell us, what is your title? What do you do at HPRC?
I am the Deputy Director for Health Policy Research and Analysis, and my role is to help figure out what's going on in public policy that impacts health outcomes, especially for vulnerable populations in the Mid-Atlantic region. So the region is Maryland, D.C., Virginia, Delaware, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania.
Byron, what exactly is public policy?
Well, public policy is kind of a shorthand for laws, regulations, guidance, policies, advisories, oversight, accountability, enforcement that we use to keep society running. Most of these affect our health either directly or indirectly. So we here at HPRC, we talk about health in all policies. And so that is our interest in public policy because it tends to impact health.
Are there different kinds of public policy or different levels where public policy takes place?
Indeed. So you can do public policy at the local level. You can do it at the community level. You can do it at the state level. You can do it at the federal level. You can even do it on a global level. A lot of the policy work we focus on is either at the local, at the state or the regional level. So at the local level, city council level, or at the state level, say here in Maryland, or at the regional level, say in the Mid-Atlantic, which is the region that we focus on.
Okay, so the local level, you're talking about the cities, the counties, the school districts, and did I miss anything?
Yes. So yeah, health departments and everybody in a local, within a local jurisdiction that is within driving distance of where you go to work or you go to school or you go to the grocery store, you go to the doctor, go to the hospital. Within that traveling distance, give or take one or two trips, is what we, how we define local.
And earlier I heard you mention that public policy can affect our lives indirectly and directly. Can you give us an example of how public policy impact our lives directly and indirectly?
So directly, one example would be the Affordable Care Act, which expanded health insurance coverage for a lot of people who are uninsured. That's a direct impact on your health. If you were previously uninsured, and because of the Affordable Care Act, you were able to get health insurance, then your health is directly impacted because now you have the means to go to the hospital or go to the doctor without necessarily being afraid that it would lead to financial ruin for you. Indirectly, we have traffic safety laws, for example, that are intended not only to keep us all safe on the road and keep our cars and transportation safe so we don't destroy them and we don't destroy the roadway, but also that we don't get hurt while we're on the road. So example is probably a mixture between direct and indirect. But it is, the first thing that somebody thinks about is how do I make sure that we don't crash the car or we don't crash the bus or the roadway, but also how is it that we can be on the road together and people don't get hurt?
So how does public policy become law?
Okay, so it first begins with a conversation. So a problem happens. People begin talking. Let's say, for example, you're home and you start smelling these fumes. You've never smelled them before. Next thing you know, somebody in the house is sick. Or you turn on the faucet and the water smells funny or it has a different color. So there's this problem. People begin to talk about it. And then people begin to ask, well, who do I call to fix it? Well, if it's bad odor coming from the faucet, from the water in the faucet, you'd call the utility that supplies the water and say, hey, guys, here's what I'm experiencing in my house. I turn on the faucet and this is a problem. And from there, you'd go to the utility and talk to them and say, how do we fix this? I paid my bill. Did you not purify the water? What is the problem? And if it turns out that it is something outside of what the utility can do to fix it, they'll tell you, well, we've done our part. Maybe it's something else. And then the conversation would now expand to everybody else that might be involved. And then this conversation would now involve policymakers or maybe an elected leader. And then it would become a hearing at the city council or in the state legislature. And then somebody would say, okay, well, obviously everything we have in place up to this point hasn't worked to prevent this problem, so maybe we need to write a law. Then somebody drafts it. Then there are more hearings, and then somebody takes the draft and they mark it up. That is, they say, okay, line one works, line two doesn't, line three works, line four doesn't. They do all that, and then they have a new draft, and then they put that to a vote. They vote. If it passes, then the elected executive, so if it's a city, then it's a mayor. If it's a state, then it's a governor. If it's a country, then it's a president. That executive signs it, and it becomes law.
So is there strength in numbers, or can an individual carry it on and still get a response?
One person can make a difference. We tell the story a lot during Black History Month and later in the year about Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat. And that is a very famous example of one person making a difference. But the untold story there, many people don't know, is that she'd been involved in this movement probably about a decade by then. And there were some other things that had happened before she refused to give up the seat. This was December 1st, 1955. The summer before was when Emmett Till was killed. There was a lot of awareness already about people wanting to do things for their community. So when, by the time she refused to give up her seat, there were already multiple things that had happened that preceded that. And so even though one person can make a difference, there is always strength in numbers, because ultimately, after she gave up her seat, they came up with a boycott of the Montgomery bus the companies that ran the buses in Montgomery, Alabama. So she refusing to give up her seat was preceded by some other things, which are often not talked about because many people don't know the full story. But after she gave up her seat, there was also the collective action.
That strength in numbers.
The strength in numbers, right. That led to a boycott that lasted more than a year, that eventually changed the circumstance they were not pleased with. So yes, there is strength in numbers. And as we've seen even this year in a lot of the collective action that people have taken about different things that they're not pleased about, sometimes one person says something, then it catches on. But usually the numbers matter, because policymakers see the numbers and they say, oh, okay, there's interest. Oh, okay, there's support. Oh, okay, if I don't do something, then there could be consequences that I may or may not like.
Like losing the election next time, right?
That's right.
So what about situations affecting a certain type or group of people, like seniors or babies? Do those tend to get a lot of attention from legislators when it comes to changing public policy?
Depends. If there is somebody who would speak up about the situation, yes. Attention comes from making noise. So it doesn't matter which group is affected. If there is not somebody who's going to make noise about the situation. So typically, there needs to be somebody with a microphone. And if it's important enough, the microphone needs to turn into a bullhorn so that everybody hears and understands and then rallies. And then the conversation can happen. Okay, how can we solve this problem?
Yeah, and sometimes certain groups of people can create that outrage. Like,
absolutely.
Especially when it comes to babies and children and seniors.
Absolutely.
Then you'll probably get more strength in numbers depending on that type of group.
Absolutely. And if you take an example, like a lot of the people who have spoken up and advocated for cancer research, for example, when they did so much activity that they eventually came up with a ribbon. Now, anytime somebody sees a pink ribbon, they know what it signifies.
That's
or
right.
A blue ribbon, they know what it signifies. Usually, you need to have enough people who can speak up and can speak clearly to the issue and say, here's the problem. Here are the people that can help us solve it. Can we go talk to them? And here's what success looks like.
Well, how can we learn more about where to go in our communities for policy-related issues? Would it be our homeowners association meetings, or tell us where we would find out that information?
Well, it depends on the issue. Say your trash pickup in front of your house is late or constantly overflowing because they're late, homeowners would do that. If you have a scenario where in the school system your vaccinations or immunizations are not occurring according to schedule, you'd need to call the health department about that. It just depends on what the issue is. The key is for individual people to know where to go. So as a rule of thumb, if it's a health-related problem, you either call your doctor or call the health department. If it is something that's affecting you in your neighborhood, you probably call the homeowners or you call the county. In Montgomery County, for example, you can call 311 about just about anything that you notice as a citizen that you think is under the jurisdiction of the county. You call 311 and they direct you to where you need to go. But part of ordinary citizens being involved in the process of making policy is that they need to be familiar with who's responsible for what. So that they can pick up the phone or they can send out a tweet. I mean, there are the social media tools, so many of them now. There's the good old telephone. There's the opportunity to write a letter. there's the opportunity to drive your car to the office if you know where it is and go and say, I'm here in person because I work down the street. I wanted to come and report X, or I have a concern about Y.
When you think about some of the unique and interesting policy issues that you've come across since being with HPRC, which one stands out as unique or interesting?
That's a good question.
Because there are a lot of different
There are a lot
ones.
Of different things. Yeah. But you see, as I said at the outset, basically any time we create public policy, it's going to impact somebody's health, whether directly or indirectly. A couple come to mind.
Like noise? I never would have thought that you can do something about noise as a public policy issue. Or
yes, noise is a good one. In some communities, they have strict ordinances and guidelines about how much noise, how late into the day, how much of it, how much of your noise the neighbor can hear. And in those circumstances, the citizen or the neighbor who's concerned about that is concerned about what is my exposure or the risk of hearing loss. So they're thinking, okay, if I can keep the noise down, I can protect my hearing.
Or sleep, for that matter.
Or my sleep. I can protect my sleep. I can protect my hearing. I can keep my concentration because maybe I work at home. There are various reasons why somebody would want to control noise. But as a health matter, too much noise impacts your hearing, and hearing loss is one of the leading causes of disability around the world. A lot of people don't realize that. So what happens is when people are concerned about that, they'll go to either the county or the city council or the mayor or whomever is responsible for that jurisdiction and say, hey, I have such and such exposure to noise. How do we write something that we can all live by?
Maybe people who live close to a strip mall and the trucks are starting either very early or very late when it comes to deliveries.
Exactly.
Airplanes flying overhead after 11 o'clock, interrupting sleep.
Exactly.
Yes.
People exactly.
We can do something about that,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So at that point, you say, okay, this noise is affecting my sleep. This noise is affecting my concentration. This noise might affect my hearing. Who do I go to? If you're in a city, you go to city council or you go to the mayor. If you're in a city or a county, you go to the county council or the city council. And, you know, you start local and look for, okay, who's the health department? Who's in charge of public works? Who's in charge of writing ordinances for public safety? You go to those bodies or those people and you talk to them and say, here's the issue. And they'll say, okay, we already have something written as policy on the books. Or, no, we don't. Maybe we need to. Do you want to get involved?
So what policy changes are experts thinking about right now that have yet to make it into popular conversation, something that's going on that we don't maybe not know about right now?
Well, one thing we're talking about in healthcare, which probably is beginning to seep out. I'm a bad person to ask about this because I'm in healthcare, but it's looking like it's beginning to seep out a little bit. There's this question about how much should we pay doctors? How much money is too much money for a doctor to make? How much should we be paying hospitals? How should we be paying them?
And that's a public policy issue?
Absolutely. Because the amount of money we pay doctors and the amount of money we pay hospitals are two big chunks of what we spend in the healthcare system. The salaries and the compensation and paying the bills for running a hospital and the salary and compensation for paying the bills for hiring and employing doctors are two of the big chunks of money we spend in the healthcare system. So there's this ongoing conversation. How much money is too much for a doctor to make? Do specialists make too much money relative to the primary care people? Do we pay hospitals too much? How are we paying them? Should we pay them every time they touch a patient? Or should we just give them one bulk sum of money for the whole year and say, here's X amount of dollars for the whole year to see Y number of patients? When that money runs out, it runs out. If you don't manage it well, you eat the extra cost. If you manage it well enough that there are savings, we split the savings. The person who's paying and the hospital or the person who's paying and the doctor split the savings. There are all these conversations going on about how we do that. And because we have to consider how much money it costs to train a physician and how much debt they carry when their training is over, the amount of debt they carry is equivalent to a mortgage. And by the time their training is done, they're thinking about starting families. And they're thinking about buying homes. So that's mortgage number two for them. So when you hire a physician is coming to you many times with the one mortgage for their training, and they're at the age where they're beginning families many times, and then they're thinking about buying a house, and then that's the second mortgage. And so if you're offering them $50,000, they're not going to take your job. They're just not going to do it.
Well, I'm sure that's going to be some interesting dialogue that's going to take place terms of that.
So the issue from a public policy standpoint is if we are paying the doctor from public funds, or if the insurance company who's running the health plan is paying the doctor. They need to decide how much am I willing to pay the physician, given that I have to pay so many of them to see so many patients. Or the same applies for hospitals. When the hospital sees a patient, if it costs the hospital $15,000 to replace your hip, this is just a random number. I don't know what it costs exactly, but if it costs the hospital $15,000 to replace the hip, the hospital could charge you $15,000 to replace the hip. That's a $0 margin for them. There's no profit in doing it. Well, if it's a non-profit hospital, that's okay. But if it's a for-profit hospital, if it costs them $15,000 to replace your hip, they're not going to charge you $15,000 to replace your hip. They're going to charge you what it costs plus a profit margin. As a public policy matter, we need to determine how much of that is fair. What's good, what's not good, who should decide that?
Okay, and that's at the national level, I take it, or?
Yeah,
okay.
National level, state level.
So how does HPRC get policy information to the public?
Papers, report, events, podcast, blog. We look for any which kind of way, wherever we think our audiences would be interested, or however they'd be interested in receiving it. If you go to our website, hprc.info, hprc.info, you can find all the various ways that we try to get the word out, all the way from a weekly blog to this podcast, which we hope will be weekly, to the papers and reports that we do, to events whenever we have them. We advertise them on social media. Follow us on social media. We try to find as many different ways as possible.
Well, this has been very enlightening for me in terms of the many different ways that we can impact public policy, but the different things that public policy is tied to is just really amazing, and I do believe you only touched the surface.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to having you on the show again.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. Remember, you have the power to use policy to improve your picture of health where you live, work, and worship. For more information on the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, visit our website at www.hprc.info. And like us on our social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr.
The research and information that we report during this show was supported by the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities of the National Institutes of Health under award number 5U54MD008-60802. The content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of the National Institutes of Health.